For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. We closed the previous program hinting at an enigma. The reason behind Eduard Strauss's barbaric act in 1907. Did he throw to the fire so much of his family's work out of envy? Or was it disappointment or shame for his son's outrageous behavior? Or was it the sad feeling of change as the old century gave way to the new and people's musical sensitivity was evolving and changing? John Suchet tells us that Edward had a very credible excuse, which emerges in the memoirs which he wrote during his retirement. He tells us that back in 1869, when Josef Strauss was already ill, the two brothers had entered into a social contract. This agreement stated that should Josef pass away, all the performing rights of his music would pass on to Edward, on condition that he would provide for Josef's widow and daughter. The agreement also provided that should Edward give up his musical career, then he would destroy all Josef's papers and provide in his will that his own be destroyed at his death, so as to avoid any of their works from falling in the hands of unscrupulous persons who might pass off the works as their own. This, in my opinion, does not explain why so much of Johann Strauss's senior and junior work were also thrown into the fire. What is certain from statements made from various founts is that Josef was working at an operetta which, like much of his work, never saw the light. The reason for this disaster remains an enigma. After his dismissal of the Johann Strauss Orchestra in 1901 and his retirement from conducting after his dramatic deed in 1907, Edward lived on until 1916. He died on 28 December 1916, bringing to a close what Suchet calls a golden epoch of Viennese music making. His death closed two generations of the most prolific of musical families, nearly 100 years after the birth of Johann Strauss' father, who was born back in 1825. ...1916 was to see the passing away of another protagonist of 19th century Vienna, the Emperor, who at the turn of the century was 70 years of age. But Franz Josef was yet to suffer more drama in his life. I read from Suchet's book. Like Johann Strauss, Franz Josef was molded by the 19th century. Here was a man who had suffered untold tragedy, seeing the world slip away from him into a new era. So we see how the two lives, that of Johann Strauss the Younger and that of Emperor Franz Joseph, were intermingled, and how each in his own manner they were the essence of Viennese life of the period. As the old century merged into the new, Emperor Franz Joseph, though loved by his Austrian subjects, was aware that he ruled over a very divided, motley group of nations. Austrians referred to him as their alter Herr, and whispered that with his passing away would come also the passing away of the glory of Austria. This was said with affection and respect, though those who uttered it could have had no inkling of how prophetic these words were. His enormous responsibilities and the tragic events of his life had taken their toll. The old emperor was tired. He lived in fear of becoming senile, finding it hard to keep up to the fast-changing world events. He looked forward to death to finally find peace and release from his duties. I read from Suchet's book. As the awful, portentous year of 1914 approached, an exhausted old man sat on the imperial throne in the Hofburg Palace, struggling to keep in touch with fast-moving events. After the tragic events of Meiling, the emperor's heir now was his nephew Franz Ferdinand, son of his younger brother, who had died. There was little affection between the emperor and his heir. In fact, we are told that thunder and lightning always raged as they had their discussions.
Emperor Franz Joseph had only sired one legitimate son, the troubled and rebellious Archduke Rudolf, whose life came to a tragic end at Meierling in 1889. As the emperor's two daughters, as females, were banned from the succession, the new heir was Franz Joseph's next surviving brother, the Archduke Karl Ludwig. He too never succeeded to the throne, dying in 1896, but left two sons, the elder of whom was Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Relations between Franz Ferdinand and his uncle, the emperor, were hardly ever of the best because of very different temperaments and ideas. What they certainly shared in common was a passion for hunting, but hardly anything else. Franz Ferdinand's role has imposed a certain necessary modus vivendi between uncle and nephew. The heir to the Habsburg dual monarchy was known for his efficient dealing with his official duties, which he carried out with due diligence. It was in his private life that Franz Ferdinand insisted on brooking no interference or imposition as to his life choice concerning a marriage partner. Not for him, an arranged and loveless dynastic marriage of diplomatic convenience and the resulting of the mechanical breeding of children to assure the survival of the dynasty. In due course, Franz Ferdinand fell in love with a beautiful young noble woman of Czech origin, the Countess Sophie Čotek. She came from a distinguished Bohemian family whose members had provided imperial ministers and others involved in related administrative duties. The family could trace its noble origins to the 12th, 13th centuries in the Kingdom of Bohemia, so they were as ancient as the Habsburgs. However, the Chorteks did not belong to a ruling sovereign dynasty, and this was a stumbling block hindering the marriage Franz Ferdinand wanted to contract with Sophie. The old emperor blocked every move in that direction, but Franz Ferdinand remained obstinately adamant, and a compromise was reached. Finally, in 1900, the couple could get married. The Archduke was then 37 and his bride 32. It came at a price. Sophie could not be styled Archduchess, and Franz Ferdinand had to renounce the succession of any sons born of this marriage, which was a morganatic one. The children, first a daughter and later two sons, were legitimate, but the sons had no right to the throne. The family lived a very affectionate, harmonious life. In due course, Sophie was raised in rank by being created Duchess of Hohenberg, but the inequality in rank rankled and remained, and she had to walk behind, not beside her husband during official ceremonies. It was this unusually close and loving relationship which made possible the frequent companionship the couple shared when the heir to the throne went to various parts of the empire on his official duties. They spent as much time as possible together, such was the deep love which bound them. That was the reason why, far away from Vienna, during that fateful summer of 1914, the couple were together when Franz Ferdinand had to visit the Bosnian capital during a tour of duty which included important military maneuvers. Bosnia-Herzegovina, a complicated melting pot of Serbs, Croats, Jews and Muslims, was in ferment. Up to 1878, it was a province of the Ottoman Empire, and according to the Congress of Berlin that year, following an Ottoman defeat in war with Russia, the Turks had to hand over the province to Austria, which bound itself to administer it and also garrison it. The largest single racial group were the Serbs, who did not take kindly to this, and in time, the resentment grew apace, encouraged by the independent Serb kingdom, which after 1903 came under the rule of the Karađorđević dynasty, louder in their saber-rattling and talk about a greater Serbia than the Obrenović dynasty whom they had replaced. Bosnia was a powder keg ready to explode. A great crisis developed in 1908 when the Young Turk movement's shenanigans in Istanbul created a wave of instability. Taking advantage of this, Austria-Hungary annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina. The crisis almost led to war, with Germany standing behind Austria-Hungary and Russia backing the Serbs. Hectic diplomacy prevented war from breaking out, but it was just a matter of time before the explosion came about. The double assassination of Franz Ferdinand and his wife, who took the first bullets when she tried to shield her husband with her own body, was to be the immediate cause of the outbreak of the First World War.
In June 1914, another tragic death in Franz Josef's family was in the making. With the aim of taking back those parts of Serbia that had been included in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, assassins awaited the arrival of the Archduke at Sarajevo. As a result of what Suchet describes as a bizarre, almost unbelievably absurd sequence of events, led to a successful assassination. As the Archduke's car carrying the August figure and his morganatic wife Sophie approached the city town hall, a group of Bosnian Serbs threw a bomb which bounced off the open car's hood, wounding two officers, but leaving the imperial couple, who proceeded to the appointment, unharmed. On the way back from the ceremony at the town hall, the driver found himself passing back through the same street, where a disappointed Gavrilo Princip was standing outside a cafe. Princhap seized the second opportunity and fired two shots at the sitting targets. Sophie, injured in the abdomen, tried to shield her husband, but a bullet hit him in the neck. By the time the limousine arrived at the hospital, Suchet writes, both the Archduke and his wife were dead. The dramatic event was to change the history of the world. When the old, frail emperor was given the dramatic news, he immediately understood the implications. This sudden death left the Austrian-Hungarian Empire bereft of an heir. But the affront by Serbia called for a political reaction which could have far-reaching effects. Austria mobilized, and the old emperor turned for advice to Kaiser Wilhelm, Emperor of Germany. The Kaiser assured Franz Josef that with Russia backing Serbia in the event of war, Germany would intervene on the side of Austria. The die was cast. The Emperor knew that there was no turning back. It will be a terrible war, he said, and how terrible he could not fathom. This is the story of the Strauss dynasty and Vienna. So again, Suchet takes us to the Viennese society, describing Viennese life leading up to the momentous event of the First World War. These were the people who had invented Gemütlichkeit, the people who had the ability to understand that the key to happiness is the acceptance of what one cannot change, which is really the message of the Fledermaus. Johann Strauss's masterpiece. For us Maltese, the perfect expression would be Herr Stamel. So life went on. Life was like an operetta, and although they had lost their waltz king, there were others to keep them entertained. The end of the 19th and the birth of the 20th centuries saw changes brought by the secession movement by Gustav Klimt and Egon Skiel, by such minds as Sigmund Freud and Arthur Schnitzer. In the chapter entitled A New Century and a New Vienna, Suchet introduces the reader to all these, but ends the chapter seeing that Viennese society was basically a musical society, with the introduction of a new musician, one who was to turn out a composition to stand comparison with those of any of the Strausses, and this is Franz Lehár, a Frenchman, who became in all, but in name, Viennese. His most famous composition was to be The Merry Widow.
Founded in 1897, the Vienna Secession was a group of internationally minded painters, sculptors and architects who resigned, indeed seceded, from the city's well-established artists' association, the Künstlerhausen, in order to form a new society with its own exhibition building and artistic ideology. The founding fathers were Gustav Klimt, Koloman Moser, Josef Hoffmann, Joseph Maria Olbrich, Max Kurzweil, and Wilhelm Bernatzik. This group was certainly inspired by its successful counterparts in Munich and Paris, sprouting in the 1890s. However, while the Vienna Secession adopted the official name of these European groups, it did not take on their artistic mission. As Hermann Bahr, a spokesman for the Vienna Secession, explained in 1898, the members of the Austrian body were not impetuous young artists rebelling against the establishment, but rather well-established artists and designers interested in expanding the definition of art and increasing its consumption by the public. Upon its foundation, visual artists were little more than second-class citizens in Vienna's cultural circles. Indeed, there was hardly any public manifestation of their appreciation. No monuments to artists, not even amateur societies for the consumption of art, could attest to their value. The Viennese public showed little interest in the visual arts, mainly as a result of the city's music tradition, predominated by the legacies of such stalwarts as Mozart, Schubert, Beethoven, and Johann Strauss. Therefore, the motivation behind the establishment of the secession was quite straightforward. As noted by musicologist and author Anna Salenza, having had enough of playing second fiddle to Vienna's revered music tradition, and intent on putting the visual arts in the forefront of Vienna's cultural consciousness, the members of the secession presented what is best described as an illusion of unity. The body pursued three primary activities. They published their own art magazine, they promoted the production of the decorative arts and interior design, and they organized and mounted a regular series of exhibitions that featured their own works and those of prominent foreign artists. The Versacrum, the secession's official magazine, was first published in January 1898. With a clear reference to the ancient city of Rome, the undisputable world capital of the visual arts, the title immediately made its agenda clear. Striving to attract respect for the visual arts in Vienna, the editors planned to fill the pages of Versacrum with original artworks, that is, woodcuts, engravings, and photographs, and avoid the long-winded program music that featured in so many other Viennese publications. The secession secured support for their organization among the up-and-coming liberal class whose members endorsed the secession's activities, and through whom word was spread about the group through Vienna's literary circles. Curiously or not a single musician was asked to write for Versacrum. Indeed, there was a conscious exclusion made by the editors, who avoided all contact with the city's music circles, in their attempt to assume the status music had possessed in Vienna. In fact, the few times that music was mentioned in Versacrum, it was generally done in a hostile manner. If, however, the secession was to acquire anything close to the prestigious status of music in Vienna, it had to make the visual arts a regular element of both public and private life. This points to their second goal. Many of the most prominent members of the secession actively pursued the fields of decorative arts and interior and furniture design. Pioneer Gustav Klimt even went so far as to produce a line of women's clothing. These efforts led to a revolution in Austrian taste and fashion, and in effect produced the turn of the century style known as Jungenstil. Visual design subsequently became an intrinsic part of every Viennese home, be it through a wallpaper pattern, the design of a liqueur cabinet, or the cut of a new ball gown. However much successful these efforts might have been with the general public, they did not sufficiently harness the respect and admiration of Vienna's top art critics. The secession had to make a bolder statement. Its artists had to classify as world-class artists, capable of producing large-scale works that could be purchased and displayed by Europe's finest museums. This points to the third goal. To this end, the Vienna Secession organized a regular series of elaborate exhibitions in a building specially designed for the purpose. Over the entrance to this building was the organization's official motto, "To each age its art, to art its freedom." The implication was that the secession was not interested in producing timeless art, Instead, they focused on creating works that captured their surroundings, the senselessness and psychosis of modern life, the spirit of fin de siècle Vienna. Despite these initial uniting goals, by the turn of the century, growing disagreements between the members of the secession concerning the objectives of the association threatened the body's success. Factionalism hit it hard. On the one side, there was the Klimt group, intent on incorporating the applied arts into the secessionist program by including designers and architects in their exhibitions. On the other side, there were the pure painter members, with Engelhardt at their head, who believed that the applied arts did not possess the same artistic quality as easel painting. The breaking point, however, unfolded in the spring of 1905, over whether the group's gallery should serve as a commercial outlet for the artists of the secession. The Klimt group was all out against what it interpreted as the overt commercialization of their association. Eventually, the Klimt group resigned from the secession, and the association started reporting a steady reduction in the number of official members. While the secession would continue, at least in name, for another 13 years, the quality of the exhibitions never matched the creative vision of Klimt, Olbrich, Hoffmann, and Moser during the first 8 years of its existence.
The Viennese had music in their blood. Although they still had their beloved old emperor, the world was changing. Bereft of their king of waltz, they gladly accepted the new musicians in vogue, and they continued to dance and be merry. Champagne continued to flow. But, Suchet writes rather dramatically, and then Gavrilo Princip fired those shots. With these dramatic words, we reach the end of this episode. I thank my collaborators, and I trust that my listeners look forward to the next episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories, The Last Waltz. Till then, goodbye.